I don't know about you, but worship today for me was just a little harder than it usually is. That's because when tragedy strikes and we're suffering, it's easy to equate that suffering with the absence of God. Does God really care? Or worse, does he even exist? Because if he existed and he cared, well, then this tragedy wouldn't have happened. And it's easy for us to think those thoughts in the wake of tragedy and as we suffer together as individuals and as a community here. When we're wrestling with our suffering, it is not an intellectual exercise. It's not a search for some logical answer that, oh, well, if we just find that answer, well, then it all makes sense. And now I can go about my life. Any suffering that I meet will be easy because now I know intellectually the answer that I should. That's not what dealing with suffering is. Dealing with suffering is rather like journeying through a dark and lonely place, just trying to get to the other side. What I seek to do today is to use God's word to help chart a path through the dark and lonely place that our church family is going through now together, and that the Bennetts and our dear brother Shane are going through now as well. And so I want to talk to you today about human suffering and God's response, because I can hear the cries of Mr. Haley, for example, when last Wednesday he made the announcement. I've heard the cries of others in prayers who through tears have up here expressed their hearts to God. And we will certainly hear the cries of pain and anguish this coming Saturday at Christie's memorial service. But what do you hear from God? It's easy to think in the wake of tragedy. It's easy to look out and just see the world going on like it does. Day turns into night, night turns into day, people keep going to work, and it seems like creation is either unaware or uncaring about the tragedy that has just struck. And what the Bible gives us, though, is it gives us the ability to hear the divine cries over human suffering that would otherwise be inaudible to our ears. And the text that I want to use this morning to help us hear God and to help us get through this dark and lonely place is a passage that probably is not the first to come to your mind. But it is 2 Kings 4, verses 18 through 37. Would you turn there for me, please? 2 Kings 4, 18 to 37. We'll read the first portion of this text together, draw some points from it, and then we'll move on and read the rest as we close out. Now, it's important I set the stage here because we're not going to read this entire story. But the prophet Elisha, who in the book of Kings, and this is very important to understand for some of the points that we're going to make, in the book of Kings, the prophet Elisha, as well as Elijah before him, is a reflection of God's point of view. Because in Kings, the book is so full of characters who do not understand God's point of view, who are rebellious to God's point of view. So when you get to Elijah and Elisha, it's important to understand what the author of Kings is doing. Yes, these men are God's prophet, but they also represent God. Their actions represent the will of Yahweh, as opposed to so many other characters in the book. And so when Elisha travels to a place called Shunem, there's a woman there, a Shunammite woman, who's married, and her husband is older, and they live alone by themselves. They have no children. And she serves Elisha. She provides him food and then provides him a place to stay. And Elisha says, I want to bless you because of what you've done for me. And he asks his servant, hey, what does she want? Do you know what she wants? And his servant says, well, she's childless, and her husband is very old, meaning the prospects of her having a child at this point are pretty much nil. And so look at, let's. I know it says verse 18 there, but look at verse 16 with me, because the widow's, or excuse me, the woman's reaction is very important. Elisha says to her, about this time next year, you will hold a son in your arms. And she says, no, my Lord, she objected. Please, man of God, do not mislead your servant. Meaning, I've wanted this so long and so badly. Please don't toy with my emotions. It's almost too good to be true. And yet Elisha says, no, 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 this is for real. Well, let's keep reading. Verse 17. But the woman became pregnant. And the next year, about that same time, she gave birth to a son, just as Elisha had told her. How glorious. Then the child grew. And one day he went out to his father, who was with the reapers. He said to his father, my head, my head. His father told a servant, carry him to his mother. After the servant had lifted him up and carried him to his mother, the boy sat on her lap until noon, and then he died. She went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God, then shut the door and went out. She called to her husband and said, please send me one of the servants and a donkey so I can go to the man of God quickly and return. Why go to him today? He asked. It's not the new moon or the Sabbath. The husband does not know what has happened. That's all right, she said. She saddled the donkey and said to her servant, lead on. Don't slow down for me unless I tell you. So she set out and came to the man of God at Mount Carmel. When he saw her in the distance, the man of God said to his servant Gehazi, look, there's the Shunammite. Run to meet her and ask her, are you all right? Is your husband all right? Is the child all right? Everything is all right, she said. But when she reached the man of God at the mountain, she took hold of his feet. Gehazi came over to push her away, but the man of God said, leave her alone. She's in bitter distress, but Yahweh has hidden it from me and has not told me why. Did I ask you for a son, my Lord? Didn't I tell you, do not mislead me. Do not raise my hopes. I want to stop there for now. This woman is in agony over what has happened to her, and with good reason. But something that she shows us, and that God shows us here in recording this for us, is that questioning our suffering is not necessarily a lack of faith. Rather, sometimes our questioning to God is born from our faith. This woman's questions, think about how this looks to the woman. She served Elisha, not to get anything out of it, but because it was the right thing to do. And then he comes to her as God's prophet and says, hey, you're going to have a son. Let this blessing come upon you for all the service you've done. Her response is, don't mislead me. I've always wanted that. Please don't mislead me. And Elisha says, no, no, no. You're going to have a son. She gets blessed with a son only to then have this young boy die. How does that make God look? Here's a son for all that you've done to my prophet. Now I'll take him from you. And so she goes to the man of God and she questions. Did I ask you for a son? Did I not tell you? Do not mislead me. Her questions are not born from a lack of faith. Her questions are born from a faith in an all-powerful, all-good God. Because if she believed in a sadistic God, well, then there's no reason to question. If God is a sadist, well, then the circumstances bear out. He gave you a son only to snatch him away because he loves to watch you suffer. There's no need to question then. Or if God is not all-powerful, then there's no need to question what's happened. God gave you a son, but then death took him. God can't do anything about that. He's not all powerful. So there's no need to question. But she questions because she knows who God is. He is all good. He is all powerful. And I can't reconcile the circumstances that have just happened with my knowledge of who God is. And so she questions. And it is not born from a lack of faith, but it is because of her faith. Brethren, strength of faith is not demonstrated in suffering by putting a strange smile on our faces and just acting like everything's okay. That is not strength of faith. That's just a facade. The Shunammite woman understood that she can question because she knows who God is. And she is just like other biblical authors who have done the same. How long, O God, is the foe to scoff? Is the enemy to revile your name forever? Why do you hold back your hand, your right hand? Take it from the fold of your garment and destroy them. Why are you there, God, and you're watching what these evil people are doing and you're not seemingly doing anything about it? That question's born from faith in who God is. How long, O Yahweh, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I take counsel in my soul and have sorrow in my heart all day? And then finally, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why have you forsaken me? What this Shunammite woman shows us, and that's borne out in the rest of Scripture, is that when we are suffering, we can bring that agony to God because He understands, and He wants us to bring those questions to Him. And He gives us these examples to show us that. But what's more, look at how God responds when we do bring those questions to Him. Would you go back to the 2 Kings passage? Would you look at verses 27 and 28 with me? When she reached the man of God at the mountain, she took hold of his feet. Gehazi came over to push her away. But the man of God said, "Leave her alone. She is in bitter distress, but Yahweh has hidden it from me and has not told me why." And then she pours out her agony to him. And brethren, what this shows us as well is that God responds to our questioning with compassion. With compassion. When she grasps the feet of Elisha, Elisha does not back away and say, "Whoa, get a hold of yourself. How dare you question what God has done?" He allows her to pour out every question and every drop of agony she has, and He listens to her because He cares, because He has compassion on her. And what this illustrates for us, what Elisha reflects, is how God responds to our questioning and to our suffering. And this is nowhere better illustrated than in when our God took on flesh and walked among us. And we read passages like this. When Jesus saw the crowds, He had compassion for them because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. And in Matthew's gospel, what that's talking about is that He looks out on the crowds and He sees all the things that have been harassing His people: sickness, deformities, demon possession, and death. And instead of God in the flesh looking out and seeing, "Well, this is the consequence of y'all's sin, so yeah, I mean, it stinks for you, but you just got to deal with it." Instead, He looks out on these things that are caused by our sin. And He looks upon human beings with compassion. And He sees us not as sinners who are just getting our just deserts, but He sees us as His creation being harassed like sheep without a shepherd. Or how about this story from Luke chapter 7? Soon afterward, Jesus went to a town called Nain, and His disciples and a great crowd went with Him. As He drew near to the gate of the town, behold, a man who had died was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow. And a considerable crowd from the town was with her. And when the Lord saw her, He had compassion and said to her, "Do not weep." Or we have these two words in John's gospel that we could spend an entire series on. Jesus wept. Our God saw our suffering and cried with us. Literally cried with us. And so what we see from the Shunammite woman and her story, as well as these passages, is that when we are in agony, we can bring our questions to God and we can know with certainty how our God is looking down on us right there in that moment. He is looking down on us with compassion. With compassion. But what's amazing is that it doesn't just stop there. God doesn't just look upon us with compassion. He takes it even further than that. Would you go back to 2 Kings? Let's finish. Now, Elisha has just responded with compassion, but the story is not over. So start reading with me in verse 29. Elisha said to Gehazi, "Tuck your cloak into your belt, take my staff in your hand and run. Don't greet anyone you meet, and if anyone greets you, do not answer. Lay my staff on the boy's face." But the child's mother said, "As surely as Yahweh lives and as you live, I will not leave you." So he got up and followed her. Gehazi went on ahead and laid the staff on the boy's face, but there was no sound or response. So Gehazi went back to meet Elisha and told him, "The boy has not awakened." When Elisha reached the house, there was the boy lying dead on his couch. He went in, shut the door on the two of them, and prayed to Yahweh. Then he got on the bed and lay on the boy, mouth to mouth, eyes to eyes, hands to hands. As he stretched himself out on him, the boy's body grew warm. Elisha turned away and walked back and forth in the room, then got on the bed and stretched out on him once more. The boy sneezed 7 times and opened his eyes. Elisha summoned Gehazi and said, "Call the Shunammite." And he did. When she came, he said, "Take your son." She came in, fell at his feet, and bowed to the ground. Then she took her son and went out. Now there are some details in that story that do strike us as odd. Why Elisha stretched himself out on the boy, mouth to mouth, eyes to eyes, hands to hand to hands. And it's very possible that some of that is just symbolism that would have made sense to an ancient Near Easterner, but it's just gotten lost over time. What I want to do is forget about those details that we kind of scratch our head a little bit. Let's look at the big picture of what we're seeing here about God's response. We saw the compassionate response of Elisha and how that reflects God's compassionate response. But it doesn't stop there. Rather, God's compassionate response to our suffering is followed by action on our behalf. Did you see that with Elisha? As soon as the woman pours out her questions to Elisha, "Did I ask you for a son? Did I not say to you, do not mislead me?" Elisha's immediate response is, "Gehazi, take my staff. Take my cloak. I want you to go to the boy's house. Don't stop. Talk to anybody." He is action-oriented because he wants to do something about this woman's suffering. And that, again, is a direct reflection of our God's response to our suffering. Now, God's response to this Shunammite woman was a temporary one. Because, yes, he used Elisha to raise her son from the dead, but that boy died again later in his life, as did the mother, as did the father. But this temporary response of God to this Shunammite woman's plight was pointing to God's ultimate response to all human suffering. What God is doing here with Elisha is pointing us to God's response to suffering through the person of Jesus of Nazareth. Note these examples here. When Jesus went ashore, he saw a great crowd and he had compassion on them and healed their sick. Compassion followed by action on the part of our God. I showed this story from Luke 7, and I ended with Christ's compassionate response saying, "Do not weep," but I left out the best part. As you keep reading, "Then Jesus came up and touched the bier, and the bearers stood still. And he said, 'Young man, I say to you, arise.' And the dead man sat up and began to speak, and Jesus gave him to his mother." fear seized them all, and they glorified God, saying, God has visited his people. And what's more, our God's action to our suffering, driven by his unfathomable compassion, his compassion drove him to take the ultimate action to deal with our suffering. It drove him to become a man and to suffer, culminating in the suffering of his agonizing death at the hands of the very creation whose suffering he came to end. This is the extent that our God suffered to make our suffering temporary, so that we could know for certainty these words. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people. And he himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. 5 years ago, I prayed as hard as I've ever prayed anything on the way to the hospital that my dad would live when he was in the ambulance and he was taken to the Tampa hospital. And what this passage means and what the suffering of our God on the cross means is that, yes, on that day, my dad passed away. But it's not that God didn't answer my prayer. It's that God hasn't answered my prayer yet. Because when this day happens, God will bring me to my father and say, Nathan, I heard you. Here he is. He lives, just like you asked me. I don't know why God chose to allow our sister Christy to pass from this life. I don't know. But what this passage means is that when this day happens, God will address us as a church. He will address Shane. He will address the Bennett family. And he will say, I heard you. Here she is. Restored. It is not that God did not answer our prayers about Christy. It's that he just hasn't answered them yet. Yet. The waiting is hard. Yes. It is hard. But this is what our God went through. This is the action he took on our behalf, so that on an eternal day in the future, God will say, I heard every one of your prayers. Here. Here's Marty Pickup. Here's Michaela. David Gentry, here you are. Body restored. David's walking in the midst of us. Here's Cindy LaMaster's body healed. Here's Angie Kite. All these people, all these things that we've prayed for, it's not that God has said, nope. It's that God has said, yes, just I need you to wait for me. Not yet. But there will be a day when God will have answered all these prayers. And what we see God's prophet doing in 2 Kings 4, 18 to 37, is what we see God doing in Jesus. We see our God suffering for us, so that our suffering will be temporary. And it's born from the unfathomable depths of his compassion for us. And it is this recognition that drives the Shunammite woman to believe something, even in the midst of her questioning. It drives the Shunammite woman to believe that God, clinging to God, is the only recourse for those who seek an end to their suffering. This woman had questions. And they were good questions. Questions born from her faith in God. But even though she had questions, she still clung to Yahweh's prophet, because she knew, I've got questions, but I'm bringing them to you because you're the only one who can do something about it. I can't go anywhere else for a solution. And brethren, when we're suffering, it's easy for Satan to start convincing us, hey, God doesn't have the answer. Look somewhere else for what you're going through, because God obviously isn't going to do something about it, or he would have done it already. It's easy for that to creep in. But the Shunammite woman knew better. She knew better. When we succumb to that thinking from Satan, we become a human being who truly has no hope, who truly has no answer for the suffering that we're going through. And this Shunammite woman lived what the psalmists say. In you, our fathers trusted. They trusted and you delivered them. To you they cried and were rescued. In you they trusted and were not put to shame. Trust in him at all times, O people. Pour out your heart before him. God is a refuge for us. Do you believe that? The Shunammite woman did. She believed it so deeply that even in the midst of her suffering and her questions, her response was, as Yahweh lives, I will not leave you. I'm not going anywhere. We may question things that happen. We may be confused. We may be angry at things that we go through and suffer through. But we will not leave the answer that we seek. We cannot leave God. For if we do, what other answer is there? What other hope is there for what we are going through? And so, to recap, what this story in Kings shows us from this great woman's faith, whose name we don't even know, but I'm so glad God recorded this for us because it shows us what God's response is, borne out in other scriptures as well. But this Shunammite woman shows us questioning our suffering before God is not necessarily a lack of faith. She shows us that God responds to our questioning with compassion. And further, God's compassionate response to our suffering is followed by action on our behalf. And finally, clinging to God is the only recourse for those who seek an end to our suffering. When our suffering causes us to feel like God is distant, remember Christ on the cross. Because that should remind us of the extent of the action that our God took to make whatever suffering we're feeling right now only temporary. I heard a preacher on the radio one time say something that it just stuck with me. For those who trust in Jesus, this life and all of its suffering is as bad as it's going to get, because our future is only in eternal glory with God, where our prayers will finally be answered. But for those who do not trust in Jesus, those who allow their suffering to drive them from God, or those that reject God outright, this life is as good as it's going to get. And that's because our God has acted for us. And so, brethren, when you're suffering, bring it to God. Bring your questions to him. He wants you to. And remember that his response to you is compassion. And it's been action on your behalf. What that means for those that cling to him, like the Shunammite woman did, for those that cling to God in their suffering, it will mean your sickness is cured, your deformity is cured, your loved ones raised from the dead, all of those prayers being answered. And in the meantime, let us pray individually and as a congregation, Lord, your kingdom come. Because when God's reign is manifested throughout all creation in its fullness, that will mean we will never have to suffer again. And so we should pray that together. This morning, to close out, we're going to sing a closing song that I think the Shunammite woman, if she were here, would have gladly sung with us. And so let's close this service by singing the Shunammite woman's attitude together. And so let's sing that together as we stand and sing.